Council, can we have appearances in Horizon Blue Cross Blue Shield of New Jersey versus Speech and Language Center?
Good morning, Your Honors. Michael Confusione of Hagee and Confusione on behalf of the petitioners.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Justices. My name is Patricia Lee. I'm at the law firm of Connell Foley. I'm representing the plaintiff respondent, Horizon Blue Cross Blue Shield of New Jersey.
Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Confusione.
Thank you for hearing the case this morning. I appreciate it. I rely, of course, on the supplemental brief that I filed with the court. I'd like to ask for 2 minutes of rebuttal, if I may. Mm-hmm. It's a very, looking at the court's actual order, it's a very narrow issue on whether or not an agreement that settlement payments are going to be non-dischargeable in bankruptcy violates, is void, essentially, is against public policy. I guess I would say a couple things to start. When we say void is against public policy under New Jersey, the first thing I would say is New Jersey law, of course, has to kind of subsume federal law, in this case, the law of bankruptcy, which is really the preeminent law that we're looking at here. If you look at the two main provisions in question, I would just point a couple of different things out. If you look at the one agreement, the second part that I cited, which it says, Ms. Arsenis agrees and intends that the judgment debt will be non-dischargeable debt. My argument there would be that contravenes actually the specific federal statute, because under the statute, it basically says all debts are dischargeable unless they're proven non-dischargeable under Section 523. And in that regard, the Bankruptcy Code places the burden of proof and the determination of non-dischargeability in the bankruptcy court. So I think that specific provision.
Under federal law, mm-hmm. could the parties to a bankruptcy proceeding in this kind of setting stipulate to the non-dischargeability of a debt?
No. They could in a bankruptcy proceeding.
That's what my question is. In a bankruptcy proceeding,
they could.
You've got all kinds of debts. You got somebody who's a debtor. They're willing to stipulate.
Right.
So if can this, and that's perfectly fine under bankruptcy.
That's fine. That's right? A dischargeability litigation.
Dischargeability litigation, right. and for whatever reason, the debtor, the debtor and the creditor go together, say stipulate.
That's right.
Can we read this provision to be a commitment on the part of your client to stipulate in bankruptcy court to the non-dischargeability of that debt?
Well, I mean, I guess you could read it like that, but even if you had read it in that regard, I cited a lot of these cases, every court that has looked at it has essentially said, if this agreement arises in the context of a pre-petition agreement, in other words, not in the context of an already existing bankruptcy litigation, that it's not valid. And I think this is why it's ultimately important. Even if you could read the clauses in question here as to not run afoul of the discrete language under the bankruptcy code, the real underlying problem, I think, and what I would submit is that the congressional intent, as I understand it under the bankruptcy code, is to give people a fresh start. And though there are exceptions to discharge, including the fraud exception under 523A, they're narrowly construed by the bankruptcy statute itself and by the case law that has interpreted that. This is what's really underlying this kind of a case, I think. You know, if you have these kinds of agreements, my adversary's argument, and really what the trial court and even the appellate division kind of said, is that, well, we'll just let the bankruptcy court decide whether or not these agreements are enforceable. But the problem is, if you allow these agreements, these provisions, rather, in these kinds of settlement agreements, it's essentially going to at least dissuade or deter people from not only seeking bankruptcy, but in other words, if you say, I agree it's not dischargeable, doesn't that at least frustrate the intent under the bankruptcy code, the purpose of the code?
You're worried about the chilling effect.
Yeah, I think it's really, that's the main, exactly, right? I think that's the main problem with the provisions.
But on the other hand, your client got a settlement that potentially almost cut her debt in half.
Yeah, I agree.
Right?
Yeah.
So, and you're arguing severability. Right. Oh, just take this out. But it seems that we have a pretty clear record
mm-hmm.
that that Horizon was not going to go into this agreement but for this provision, right?
Yeah.
So when you say sever that out but give my client the benefit of having a $950,000, obviously coming out of an alleged fraud, a $950,000 obligation to Horizon to pay money back that they say was procured by fraud, suddenly cut to 500. Your client gets.
I don't.
You're an excellent lawyer. But your client gets all the benefit of.
Yeah, I agree, Your Honor. That I think, and I don't want to jump ahead of myself. Yeah. And obviously, it's up to the court. I don't think I could take that position that the remedy that's dictated is just to strike out the two provisions. I think at the very least, my adversary, the client, you know, Horizon, would have the opportunity to say whether or not it still wants to proceed into the settlement.
Are you arguing severability? Have you ever argued severability?
I don't think I really ever. I did say that the provision should be stricken.
Yeah. That's,
but I think I agree with Your Honor that that's not really a legitimate.
I mean, it's ultimately pretty unfair.
I can't dictate that, or my client specifically can't dictate it. I agree.
I thought you were telling us to take the provision out. And
I mean, you know, it's hard for me to take a position that I personally think is kind of unreasonable. And if the court says these two provisions in the agreement that we're talking about are invalid, I don't know if the court can hold Horizon to the same agreement by simply striking out the provision.
Right, but I thought you were trying to get out of the agreement.
Say it again, Judge.
I thought you were trying to get out of the agreement.
Based upon
am I right or wrong?
Yeah, no, you're right.
I kind of wanted to get out of part of the agreement.
I mean, look, the position my client took below was to say we didn't agree to these terms. And I know that's not before the court. I think what Your Honor, though, was saying is let's say that the court agrees with me and says these provisions are invalid. If we go then to the remedy, can I really say, well, they have to accept the agreement without two provisions? I don't think conceptually I could take that position because I don't think that's the right result.
That seems like a fair concession because to Horizon, this seemed to be a critical paragraph in the agreement.
Right. I think Horizon could say, Your Honor, given now that the two provisions in question are stricken, they should have the right to say whether or not they want to continue under the settlement was reached or they want to say, well, forget it then. We're going to keep going with the claim. I think that's conceptually the right result from a legal standpoint.
Okay, so you're saying whatever mention is made of striking a provision, which I viewed as severability.
Right.
That we should assume this is an all or nothing proposition.
Yeah, and I think it would probably be, I mean, my view would be something like we remand back to allow Horizon to determine whether or not it wants to continue with the agreement with the provision stricken out or say forget it, then we're not agreeing.
I haven't looked at this issue.
Right.
I assume you have. Is there was the Horizon's action, would it still be timely if it were renewed? Or would you have an argument that they've either through statute of limitations or latches or some argument? Would you pursue such an? I mean, if you're saying they can go ahead, would they then be turning around and seeing a statute of limitations argument?
I mean, again, I'm only an appeal lawyer, but I don't think there would be a statute of limitations issue.
Yeah.
That's my instinct.
But I'm just trying to get, you know.
Yeah, no, I understand.
You're saying the remedy is they get the opportunity to decide, do we start over with our claim?
Yeah, and I don't think that Horizon should be prejudiced if, in fact, the agreement, if the provisions are declared unenforceable, as I argue they should be, I don't think that Horizon should be somehow prejudiced, in fact, you know, because they didn't know they were going to be stricken.
Does your argument require this court to actually decide whether or not the language that ended up in this agreement that's before us actually does waive dischargeability?
No. I think that all the court would have to say is it frustrates or kind of violates the purpose or intent behind the congressional remedy of bankruptcy. And to the extent it may dissuade people from even seeking bankruptcy protection, it can't be in an agreement like this. I think if the court just said that, that's probably sufficient, in my view, conceptually, to conclude the way I urge the court to go.
So you feel the courts that considered this already erred in just saying,
yeah,
the question of dischargeability is not before us.
Yeah, exactly.
Even if this is a waiver, the bankruptcy court gets to decide
Yeah, like even if you look at the appellate division's decision, they talk about, well, we're not going to render advisory opinions and all that, but mm-hmm. that's
on page. Would it be a legitimate provision to say,
mm-hmm.
if a petition in bankruptcy is filed, then Ms. Arsenis, agree to stipulate to the non-dischargeability of this debt?
No. I don't think you could do that because, again, the problem is we have the federal law that's basically handcuffing us all, essentially. And whether or not you conclude the language of the statute prevents that. Like, even if you look at this 523, Your Honor, if you look at the subsection C, which kind of talk, even if you look at that, it basically says on notice and hearing, the creditor can say, hey, this specific debt isn't dischargeable. Even that in and of itself subsumes within it, I would submit, that there's some kind, if you have notice and a right to a hearing for the debtor, then obviously the debtor has some kind of a right to contest. And I think you can't have a pre-petition waiver of the right to contest because that violates, again, if not the specifics of that statute, it violates the purpose of bank.
It may prejudice other creditors, too. I mean,
it could.
Because you have a limited pie, and
right.
the question is, who's going to get it?
Right.
Isn't this a muzzling? This is more of a muzzling provision.
Yeah.
Because
I agree.
And that we've held even in our state, at least in the sentencing, you're deprived when one party is told that it can't speak, it's depriving the court of maybe valuable information that could be provided to it.
Agreed.
But people stipulate all the time not to pursue claims.
Yeah, they
do. Nothing wrong with that.
Yeah. Go ahead, Justice.
No, you go ahead, please.
No, I was just going to say, and if this didn't involve federal law, then maybe this court could say, well, New Jersey, we have to kind of weigh and balance the policy.
I mean, it's not muzzling somebody to release a claim. Someone could release a claim under state law,
right.
and even though a court down the road might be very interested in hearing about that claim, mm-hmm. that release is still valid, right? Happens all the time. People release claims.
Well, but the problem is, again, that we're now dealing with the supreme federal law.
No, I'm saying that, but there's nothing.
You're saying about more generically, yeah.
But the problem seems to be the stipulation to the point of discharge, as Justice Patterson is questioning you about.
Yeah.
But is there any reason why your client couldn't have agreed to not contest that this was fraud if there was a later bankruptcy action?
Well, she...
Because that would implicate...
Right.
Clearly, I think, state interests that are allowable.
I think Your Honor makes the correct distinction, in my view. In other words, again, going back to the very specific provisions in question here, they reference those specifics of the bankruptcy code and talk about dischargeability. There were other things that had been contested below and are not before the court here, and I'm not re-arguing them, but that talked about whether or not there was fraud involved. And that was a highly contested issue. It's not before the court. That's okay.
My point is not that the agreement would concede fraud in this action, but that if there was a later bankruptcy action, your client hypothetically, would not contest a fraud.
I think the problem, again, I go back to this 523, even if you look at the subsection C, which talks about non-dischargeability. Essentially, it says everything's dischargeable unless a creditor shows it's not. And then if you look at the C, it vests that determination in the bankruptcy court, and it also talks about the burden of proofs on the creditor, and it's a notice and a right of notice and hearing. So if we go with what Your Honor just articulated and said, why is that not okay? It's not okay because those rights are subsumed, if not in the language of the subsection C of the bankruptcy code, certainly the purpose of it.
And it's going to affect all the other creditors.
And it's going to affect all the other creditors.
And it seems to me that Horizon could have accomplished its goal if it got your client to admit to fraud.
Right.
But throughout this agreement, there are no admissions, can't be used against us, no inferences. So your client protected herself and her company in that fashion. Yes?
Yes.
And not just in this action, but from those findings being used in connection with other contract arrangements.
Right. And again, at least when I looked at the law, and it's possible I didn't see some things, but it certainly looked like, if not every case, it certainly looked like most cases that looked even specifically at pre-petition agreements that it's not going to be dischargeable have said invalid under federal background. It was like, literally like a whole cornucopia of cases. So I think it's a fairly straightforward issue in that regard.
But you don't dispute at all that since we have no petition here, we're not in bankruptcy. Your client's not in bankruptcy.
That would be valid.
That the remedy here, if this provision is stricken, is to find it to be material to the entire contract and strike the whole contract, at which point you're back to square one.
Yeah, I think that's the required remedy. Again, unless Horizon, who has the power essentially to say, well, it's okay anyway, we're going to go forward. Whether or not that technically be a new agreement or not, I don't know. But I agree with Your Honor conceptually. They can't be forced to accept the agreement without these two provisions in it. Unless the court has anything further, I thank you again for hearing the case. Nice to see the court in person again.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Lee?
May it please the court. Respondent respectfully requests the affirmance of the decisions below and the rejection of the request to gut the party settlement agreement. I believe the questions that the justices proposed hit the nail on the head in this case. There is, and the appellants have fatally failed to address, a distinction under federal decisional law as to waiver versus the application of collateral estoppel. While waiver is against public policy, and that has not been disputed below, the application of collateral estoppel is not. Counsel has indicated that his search for cases has revealed no other case on point. However, appellants have relied on two critical cases in federal jurisdictional law that say otherwise. We've cited in all of our briefs below, Klingman versus Levinson, a 1987 Seventh Circuit decision. That decision is hard to miss because it is cited approvingly, although distinguished factually, in the only unpublished Third Circuit decision addressed in the appellate division's footnote below, in Ray Sherpka. If one were to shepherdize that case, you will come across a Ninth Circuit affirmance that was issued in November of 2019 in In Re Johnson, which is also cited in the appellant's brief. In that case, it followed Levinson in deciding that nearly identical language in a settlement agreement, as well as in a terms for a consent decree or a consent judgment, here we have a confession of judgment, were not unenforceable, void, and must be stricken. They were not deemed waiver of any bankruptcy rights. What they were, however, was evidential of the party's intent to meet and apply the standards for collateral estoppel. And because of that agreement, that identical language that was in the settlement and in the consent decree, the bankruptcy court decided with free and independent judgment in an adversary decision to grant the creditor summary judgment. And the appellate courts affirmed. Notably, the 2019 affirmance from the Ninth Circuit was a unanimous 3-judge circuit court panel. That panel affirmed a 3-judge bankruptcy court sitting as appellate court as well in the Ninth Circuit. And that court in turn had affirmed the chief bankruptcy judge. Now, I've pulled down the pleadings, the briefs, the settlement agreement, but the case in In re Johnson is indistinguishable from the case here. The parties had a settlement agreement. By all terms, they avoided a trial. There was an underlying fraud claim in the state court complaint. The settlement made clear that the settlement was a resolution of fraud claims, so that there could be no ambiguity later that there was some kind of novation or some other settlement of a non-fraud alternative count. It made clear and resolved any ambiguity that the settlement was on the basis of the fraud claims. The agreement in In re Johnson also made clear that upon a breach, upon a default, and in that case, the default happened 5 years later, the creditor can file the consent judgment with the state court, and all of the complaint allegations will be treated as true, that there would be no contest of them. That is strikingly similar to the clause in our agreement, because it was based on that decisional law. And the clause in our agreement indicates that upon a default, which has already happened here immediately, the creditor here, Horizon, can enter a confession of judgment supported by an explicit affidavit that was in the material term sheet approved by the court below, that the allegations in the complaint for fraud specifically are to be treated as true. They support the entry of the judgment without need for further evidence, without need for a trial, and the appellants agree not to contest them. Now, people can include in a settlement agreement standard, I don't admit liability, because they know that this could rise to a criminal inquiry. Someone could request the settlement. They may never default. But here, the agreement was expressed, and it wasn't in some document that never saw the light of day. It was in a material term sheet presented to the trial court judge, who had a hand in negotiating it over weeks and weeks and finally emanating in a settlement put on the record with voir dire on the eve of trial. In re Johnson, Levinson, and several other cases in that same vein. One particular case I will note for your honors is In re Nardone. That's a District of Massachusetts case, 2008. They all say the same thing, that there is a distinction between collateral estoppel and waiver. We have never disputed below, and nor did the trial court rule, that these clauses constituted a waiver. And because, as appellant's counsel admitted, there cannot be any waiver. The bankruptcy code is explicit since 1970. In fact, it has been explicit in section 524A that regardless of whether or not a discharge has ever been waived previously, the bankruptcy court has the absolute power to assess that judgment, whether it's by consent, whether it's after a verdict, and to ascertain independently whether the settlement debt or the judgment debt that has not yet been satisfied arises from fraud. We have simply, in settling this matter, the respondents have simply attempted, as the court has recognized, in exchange for giving up not 50% of its potential damages, 90%. This settlement was 10 cents on the dollar because of treble damages and attorney's fees. This case was involving more than $10 million, litigated over 5 years with premier experts, countless depositions. Summary judgment motions were denied. This was going to trial. It would have been a long trial, and the defendants did not want that trial. So they wanted a settlement. But what respondents didn't want to have happen, just like the court in In re Johnson agreed, was 5 years later, because our settlement provided for payments over 4 years. 4 years later, to have a default on the big balloon payment that was due, and now we would have stale evidence and stale witnesses. That was not the goal, because we would have had no incentive not to try.
Well, you completed your opening statement?
Yes, I can circle back to a couple more points, but I'm happy to answer questions.
I have a question for you then. Collateral estoppel. Generally, there is a fact that is proven that later in a subsequent proceeding must be accepted by the court. Or there obviously there are a variety of things. What is it that you contend under principles of collateral estoppel must be accepted under this agreement by the bankruptcy court? Because I don't see fraud admitted, right? There's no admission of fraud here.
Yes, and our position is that the agreement here, the stipulation here, which was clear in the default provision, the fraud complaint would be deemed admitted in the sense that they will be stipulated to as part of the confession of judgment and will be entered without any contest.
How can you say that? I want to follow up on Justice Patterson's question, because that's what I was thinking, and she happened to articulate it. I'm looking at page 13 of the agreement. I'm just going to quote part of it. This agreement and the settlement represents does not constitute an admission by the parties of any violation of any federal, state, or local law or any duty whatsoever, whether based in statute, common law, or otherwise, or of any liability. And the parties expressly deny any such violation of liability. Nothing in this agreement nor any act or omission relating thereto is or shall be considered an admission, concession, acknowledgement, or determination of any alleged liability. I can't imagine a stronger denial of liability than what you have permitted in this settlement agreement. Do you agree?
I believe, Your Honor, in looking at it's
so this goes to the very question that Justice Patterson asked. Collateral estoppel has to be based on a fact. That's a denial of a fact. And the bankruptcy provision is a muzzling provision. It's merely saying that the plaintiff agrees not to contest the non-dischargeability. So you can go into bankruptcy court and say, this is non-dischargeable, and the plaintiff just has to sit silent there. And then the court may demand facts. But I'm trying to understand this collateral estoppel argument.
Well, Your Honor, first of all, the court below did not address the collateral estoppel argument because the case law is clear that that argument should be addressed first by the bankruptcy court.
Where is the admission? Where is the fact?
Your Honor.
That's what Justice Patterson asked, and I'm looking for it.
The case law provides that consent judgments can be collateral, can be even given a collateral.
How can you say that there is an admission to any allegation in the complaint based upon what I just read?
You're reading a provision in the settlement agreement. I understand, Your Honor, and that's there. There was a separately negotiated default provision whereby there will be a specific language in a stipulation, and if there's inconsistencies, then the bankruptcy court would hold a hearing and would assess that. But the language that is addressed in the cases, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Look at section 3.1 of the agreement under notice of breach. And in the middle of that paragraph, it says the confession of judgment, the separate document that accompanies this agreement, shall explicitly state that while Ms. Arsenis does not admit liability or wrongdoing, she agrees, and then it goes on, that her settlement payment obligation to Horizon, as set forth in the agreement, resolves Horizon's claims enumerated in the civil complaint. That is the furthest I've seen anywhere in this document that relates to a fact connected to fraud. And that is insufficient, I suggest, unless you can point me to something that says that's an admission.
Your Honor, I believe that it is an agreement in the default provisions to the entry of a judgment without contesting and treating as true all facts in the complaint. There was language in the other agreements as well in several other cases that come out of In re Levinson, where the courts found either that collateral estoppel was warranted or that at minimum a hearing was necessary.
Like any other settlement agreement, they're not. Look, you're saying they should have owed $10 million, okay? You settled for $950. So we don't know what the facts are. And no one would know what the facts are from looking at this settlement agreement. You've just come to terms. And that confession of judgment merely means that if they breach the agreement, they've got to pay the $950. That's all that that says. Am I mistaken?
No, the agreement requires a supporting executed stipulation agreeing that the debt arises from the fraud claims in the complaint and that the allegations can be entered in support of that judgment based on the fraud claims without any contest.
Is there a confession of judgment existing somewhere that's outside of the record? I mean, does it exist?
Well, we never got that far because they refused to sign it. But the explicit terms of what those documents were to contain and that they were going to be executed within 10 days is what we sought to enforce. And all I'm saying, Your Honors, is that
they didn't sign it. We're talking about facts. They didn't agree to anything. They didn't sign the confession of judgment.
They agreed to what the terms of it would be. That's the same as you agreed to a settlement agreement and you didn't sign it, Your Honors. The reality is that they are seeking to assert a black letter rule that language like this, meaning that the parties include language that say, we express an intent and understand that there could be preclusive effects later by agreeing that this debt sounds in fraud. The bankruptcy exception.
If we were to disagree with you and determine that purely as a matter of federal bankruptcy law, this is not enforceable at this stage pre-petition, is it your position that you should be, the entire agreement should be voided and not, as I believe it's your adversary has conceded, and not purely pull out these agreements? I mean, you've made a very strong case that this was an essential component of this agreement from your client's perspective, correct?
Your Honor, if I can, just one moment. The essential part of the agreement is the stipulation not to contest the facts and that the debt arises from fraud.
You agree, you've said that. You've made very clear in your papers that your client would not have entered into this agreement but for that provision. And I assume your position is that if, I know you want the court to enforce the provision, but if the court were to determine that federal bankruptcy law this is inconsistent with federal bankruptcy law pre-petition, is it your position that the entire agreement should be voided and you simply should be permitted to proceed as you would have proceeded but for the settlement against this defendant?
I do note that the agreement does not have a severability clause, but it depends, because we have already agreed below, and the trial court ruling is consistent, that there's no objection to there being some kind of prophylactic language in the order that it's not intending to predetermine or invade the jurisdiction of the bankruptcy.
I fully get that's your position that you're pursuing in this appeal. I'm not in any way trying to ask you to back off of that, but if the court were to disagree with you on your argument that this provision can either be reformed or can be enforced as is, is it your position? I think it would be self-evident that the entire agreement should be scrapped, to use a colloquial word, and you should be permitted, I'm sure not happy about it, but you should be permitted to proceed with your fraud claims against the defendants.
I think that's fair. I mean, because if they're looking to gut, it's not really clear, it keeps evolving, gut a substantial portion of this agreement.
And I would rather try my fraud case now. That's why I started with this, because I thought I was reading in your adversary's brief a suggestion that they get to get the benefit of this quite beneficial agreement without that provision, which was, you made clear, was important to you. I just want to understand that if your position is that if the court disagrees with you on the issue of federal bankruptcy law, you would say all bets are off, the agreement's void in its entirety, and you can just go back and seek what you indicated is more than $950,000, is a $10 million claim.
Correct. That's correct.
Can I just clarify a couple of things? The confession of judgment, which is part of and to be attached to the settlement agreement, was never executed by the defendant, correct? Was there ever any kind of application, motion, or effort to compel the defendant to sign the confession of judgment?
Yes, that was the provision below. So that was the settlement agreement had the attachments, and that was what they refused to sign.
I understand. Was there an application to compel them to sign it or to effectuate the filing of the confession of judgment?
To sign it.
Just sign it. And that was denied, granted?
It was granted.
So, but the confession of judgment was never signed. Nevertheless, there is a court order requiring that it be signed. So from your standpoint, there is a confession of judgment.
Correct. And there was a denial of a stay of that obligation as well as an obligation to appoint.
So from your standpoint, there is a confession of judgment, and that can now be enforced with the attached court order and the settlement agreement. And that confession of judgment requires that they agree that the facts contained in the complaint are stipulated to, essentially accepted as true. They're not contested.
Correct.
And your argument is that those facts establish fraud and make the debt non-dischargeable. Is one of the possible outcomes here that you're seeking, I think, that we say this is a matter for the bankruptcy court, essentially confirm that it's premature, and all of your requests, applications, enforcement be dealt with by the bankruptcy court under the theory of estoppel?
That's exactly the
outcome. So if the bankruptcy court decides that there is no estoppel here, there was no settlement agreement, or whatever, or that that was procured against public policy or constitutes an illegal waiver, you're out of luck. You got to start over. But if they decide estoppel does apply, then you can continue to pursue and enforce the settlement agreement. That's pretty much your contention.
That's correct.
On the other hand, coming before us now, if we decide this clause is void against public policy in New Jersey and unenforceable here, so that anything you get as a result of that clause, and therefore the settlement agreement, is out the window, start over. Correct?
Correct.
However, if we do that, you could still be in bankruptcy court and still attempt to prove in the bankruptcy court that this debt was incurred by fraud on the part of the defendant and therefore non-dischargeable.
The Supreme Court has made that clear.
And so that when you're in the bankruptcy court making that claim, your claim is for the whole $10 million or whatever it is, whatever that number is that you say the defendant owes to you under the having perpetrated fraud. Correct?
Correct.
Okay. I'm just want to make sure I don't misunderstand where we're headed.
Can I add one question?
Take what Justice Solomon has just said. If you accept everything he said that you agreed with, why wouldn't you just sever this provision? Because your adversary said he's bound to live by it, and then you'd have the confession of judgment. Like, why wouldn't you do that?
I've reached out to try and resolve this case. I mean, I don't know if that's...
No, I'm trying to understand your position.
Yeah.
And this is the question is whether or not you'd want to throw the entire agreement on the rocks or whether or not you'd try to keep it alive with this provision severed. Because with this provision severed, you've just told us that this confession of judgment has admissions that you can use in the bankruptcy court. And the plaintiff's going to be up to... arsonist is going to be up the creek. So, like, why would you want the entire agreement to be struck? I'm trying to figure that out.
Well, it's a material. We're dealing with material terms here. I don't know in a vacuum what the ruling ultimately will be here, and that decision will be made once I know that. But this is a matter that has been litigated, by surprise attacks at all turns. So I can't say yet what might ultimately be the outcome, but we're just trying to get some closure.
Just assume, for the sake of argument, the court hasn't decided anything, that the provision is deemed to be contrary to public policy, the bankruptcy provision. That has to go. You want to start from zero, or do you want to enforce the remainder of the agreement?
I don't know, Your Honor.
Okay.
And then you've got an issue with respect to an unsigned. I mean, I think from your perspective, it's probably of some concern, even though you've got a court order, that on a collateral estoppel, you don't have a signature with respect to the facts. I think that's probably a concern.
It is. And honestly, I mean, the default was almost immediate here. So this is even contrary to In re Johnson, which was 5 years later.
Yeah.
This was almost immediate. There could be some other issues on fraudulent intent to even enter into the settlement.
Let me ask you a question just to be clear, and I haven't looked into this, the law on this at all. Is there any, you I assumed, dismissed your where were you in the litigation? You were heading to trial.
The case, we were on the eve, it was
eve of trial.
Labor Day weekend. We were on the eve of trial.
Okay.
For the day after Labor Day, and we settled that Friday before.
Okay. So you agreed as part of the settlement to dismiss your complaint with prejudice, but if the entire settlement agreement goes, you've got a you can refile that complaint.
Correct.
Are you dealing with any issues of, and you know, you, this is a left field question, so I will thoroughly understand if you don't know the answer to this, but would you have any concerns about either the statute of limitations, a latches defense, or anything else that would be a technical impediment to your proceeding against these the individual in the business if the settlement agreement were scrapped?
I don't believe so. I think because
you just pick up where you left off and get your file out of storage.
Just another left field question. At the time that you were resolving this matter, were there any other collateral criminal insurance fraud matters that were ongoing and related to this and resolved in any way?
Well, a lot of times those are confidential, but we did have to, under the IFPA, mm-hmm. send a notice, and the case was being monitored, and per the agreement at the end of the case, a letter gets sent indicating that the case has been resolved.
Thank you. Is there anything more that you'd like to add to your argument? Or
I would just stress, Your Honors, that the case law in terms of collateral estoppel and these provisions in general, the decisions I mentioned in In re Johnson and in Levinson, there's additional cases, In re Gibbs. There is a line of cases that indicate that the parties, what might be viewed as invading the bankruptcy court on the one hand, if you're seeking to prevent someone from filing, for instance, you can't file for 180 days, or you can't list my debt, or you can't seek a stay, that's different from seeking to settle a matter that actually sounded in fraud below, that was litigated fulsomely with competent counsel, with scorched earth discovery and motion practice, and agreeing that the fraud, even though we didn't try it, that debt will arise out of fraud, because the common law elements of fraud are the same as in the statutory exception. It was defendant's counsel that asked for the swap, and that's set forth in my affidavit below. It used to say fraud, and they changed it saying, why don't we just use the bankruptcy citation? It means the same thing. And now they're using that to their advantage. Had it said fraud and not the bankruptcy citation here today, we wouldn't be here. And that is what Levinson and In re Johnson says is not a distinction with a difference. Because so, these...
Just to understand, did the language about 11 U.S.C. 523 come from the defendants?
Yes. So the agreement as drafted indicated that there would be a stipulation that the claims arose out of fraud. And they asked, instead of saying that, fraud, false pretenses, and false representations.
So what the provision, to the extent that it refers to bankruptcy, that they're seeking to undo here was a provision that they requested.
Correct. Now, there was information indicated so that we could show the intent and the comprehension, so there was no ambiguity later, that they understood this could have preclusive effect. That was the goal. That was the goal, not to just push this to another forum and have another six-month trial. The goal was to give some sort of finality to the ability you had your time to contest the allegations in the complaint.
Question. This is about just the concept of collateral estoppel. That is typically where there is some sort of fact alleged in one court that is can't be disputed in another court. We're just dealing with an agreement here. I'm trying to wrap my head around this whole collateral estoppel. I could understand your argument being they've admitted to this, they've stipulated to this, but the concept of collateral estoppel does not seem to be applicable here. Am I off?
Your Honor, I've spent the better part of the last 2 days reading almost every collateral estoppel case out of the bankruptcy court, and I will tell you that it's an issue preclusion doctrine. That doesn't mean we might wholly get collateral estoppel. We might only get it on the fact that the debt emanated from fraud claims. We might not get it on intent. The court might hold a hearing on that. It could be a partial application. That's what these bankruptcy courts have all addressed. It can narrow the issues for a hearing. That was the goal. The goal was, in giving up these rights, we were getting some sort of prevention of a second bite of the apple, of a full do-over, because we were ready to go to trial. We were not, and the agreement, and let me just make this point to Your Honors. The agreement, as much as they're saying it was invading the bankruptcy court, in several places it acknowledged that the bankruptcy processes would apply. It says if and when they file for bankruptcy, they were allowed to file for bankruptcy. If they listed this debt, it notes in 11.2 in the confidentiality provision that we would be able to accept confidentially so that we could prosecute a dischargeability complaint. That is completely consistent with this agreement not being a waiver of rights, but rather the language, in particular the default provisions, just like in In re Johnson, were set up for collateral estoppel purposes. That is not void as against public policy. What they're asking this court to do is sit as judge and jury of what a bankruptcy court would do with that language and whether or not they would find any preclusive value whatsoever from the stipulation that the defendant was required to file and the agreement not to contest any of the facts as part of a consent judgment. A consent judgment can be given collateral estoppel effect. As to a default judgment, if it's been shown that there was a purposeful decision not to contest, that you've actually been involved with the proceeding, I believe that under this case law, this consent judgment with the stipulation would be given some preclusive effect. But I'm not the decider of that. That's the exclusive jurisdiction of the bankruptcy court. But what those cases say is—
We don't have the confession of judgment, do we?
We have an agreement of the language. That's what these material term sheet, I've never done one like this. It was explicitly negotiated with the court.
Where is it in the record?
I'm sorry?
No.
Can you give us a citation in the record where we can find the confession of judgment?
I believe it's attachment to the motion for enforcement, and it's attached to the settlement agreement.
Can you give us an appendix number?
Sure.
If that's possible.
One second. CA 15 to 35, and the confession of judgments forms are specifically at the confidential appendix 30 to 35.
Thank you.
Confidential appendix 30 to, I'm looking at the appellate division confidential appendix. There's another.
It's for the appellants. The appellants confidential.
No. I'm looking at the your confidential appendix in the appellate division. Is that what you're referring to? Or you have the other one? There's one for us. I'm sorry. Ignore that.
Confidential appendix dated, it's filed February 18th, 2020 in the appellate division.
In the appellate division?
Correct.
Okay.
Paragraph 4 at confidential appendix 35 indicates, I further agree not to contest Horizon's allegations so that a confession of judgment may be entered without the necessity of introducing evidence or the conduct of a trial. That is the provision that we believe falls squarely within In re Johnson.
Read that again one more time, slowly.
Sure. I further agree not to contest Horizon's allegations so that a confession of judgment may be entered without the necessity of introducing evidence or the conduct of a trial.
So with that provision being enforced, did you even need the paragraph that immediately is above it? I agree and intend that the judgment debt will be a non-dischargeable debt pursuant to Section 5523A2 in the event of a bankruptcy.
That language, it was taken as a similar language to what's in Ray Levinson and Emory Johnson. Because it's intended, in order for a consent judgment to have collateral estoppel effects, the court needs to have some assurances that the parties anticipated and intended that there could be preclusive effects in a subsequent proceeding. That language designed to avoid that ambiguity.
Thank you.
It's not designed to usurp the ability of the bankruptcy court to make an independent finding.
I'm looking at paragraph 4 is the same, like it's like 3.8. It's basically the same. Agrees not to contest the non-dischargeability, but that's you're agreeing not to contest the allegations. And you're taking that as an admission.
They agree not to contest the Horizon's allegations. That is what cases have found is a consent judgment. You can consent to a default judgment, and then the counts on which that judgment is entered is the underlying fraud claims, and that's what this is designed to specify so that there's no ambiguity or argument later that, for instance, it was based on not fraud claims. That was the goal of this issue. To the extent it can have preclusive impact in whole or in part, In re Johnson, Levinson say that that's an issue for the bankruptcy court to decide in the context of an adversary proceeding.
But you, what you have provided with the addition of the order that they sign this, which they have yet to do, what you have seen in the Seventh Circuit case as all that's necessary to at least give the bankruptcy court what it needs to consider in order to make a determination as to whether there's preclusive effect.
That's correct. If we thought something more was needed under the cases, we would have given more. In re Nardone is the District of Massachusetts case out of 2008. That's takes Levinson and puts it in a bite-sized summary for everyone, addressing the two issues here. One, rejecting that language is a per se waiver because it can't be, because parties can't contract away the rights to discharge. It's not self-executing. If the respondents never filed a petition in the adversary proceeding, the discharge would encompass the debt. But at the same time, the court said, supporting with Levinson, that a settlement agreement that called for a consent agreement upon default, that says, we agree not to contest the allegations in the complaint, so that entry of that judgment can be based on those counts.
Counsel,
that is collateral estoppel.
I think we have your point. Would you care to wrap up your argument, please?
Sure. From our perspective, Your Honors, we believe that the public policy and the equities here weigh in favor of affirming the judgment. This is a case where if it's not clear that language is per se void because of the line of cases that deal with collateral estoppel, that this issue should be left to the province of the bankruptcy court. It was not impermissible for the courts below to say that this issue was not ripe, that it would be advisory, or that it should be addressed in the connection with that proceeding at a later point.
This is the last question. If we knocked out the bankruptcy clause, you'd still have this. I just don't understand. Why wouldn't you want the rest of the agreement to go into effect? You've got that confession of judgment language. You'd still have all the arguments that you have.
Well, Your Honor, I just don't know what you're talking about knocking out the language, because they broadly are looking to knock out 11.2, 3.8, four paragraphs in the confession of judgment. So, what was originally raised in the trial court was that they didn't like that statutory citation. So we were like, well, let's swap it with the word fraud. Let's make sure it wasn't invading the province of the court, but now it's morphed. So I don't know what ultimately will be the holding here and how much it will gut the agreement.
Your concern is that the confession of judgment could be extricated along with that provision?
They've explicitly, in this, if you look at the petition here, they've asked for four paragraphs of that supporting affidavit, which was set forth and consistent with, as the court held below, the material term sheet to be voided.
You view their effort to be to ultimately get out from under the confession of judgment?
Correct. And then there would be a complete open field here for years later to have to completely redo the entire case. The goal here was, although the bankruptcy court needs to fairly assess the evidence, can look outside the judgment, all of that case law is clear. The goal here was to meet what had happened in Ray Levinson and in Ray Johnson, as if there's a default, you're stipulating to the facts in the complaint, which they agreed to do. And that has been upheld below as voluntarily and knowingly done.
Does the court have any further questions?
No, not with this person, but I'd like to know whether he's seeking to knock out the conviction.
Counsel, thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Confucione, Justice Albin would like to ask a question.
I just have one question.
Sure, Your Honor.
Are you seeking to knock out 3.8 and only 3.8?
3.8 meaning those two main provisions I cited at the beginning of my page one.
Yes.
Yeah, and then I think that there is one, if you bear with me for a minute, I actually marked here what I thought was no good.
The reason I'm asking that, are you not asking to knock out the confession of judgment?
No, I think what the court has granted the petition on, no, I'm not, only to the extent that it has the same problem that the two provisions I cited have in terms of either agreeing to waive any kind of right under the bankruptcy.
But what does that mean? So you're now under...
I think there's one section in the confession of judgment that repeats that same language.
So you are looking to gut
that. That part of the confession of judgment is no good for the same reason it's no good in the final
settlement. But not the part where you don't contest the allegations.
Right.
That is legitimate.
In the procedural posture before the court,
yes.
That's not before the court.
But you're not committing to not make the... If part of it goes out, and I understand, you know, we're putting you on the spot here, but...
Yeah.
You're not committing to say that confession of judgment would have all of the preclusive effect that the bankruptcy court might give it. You'd be in there arguing, or somebody would be in there arguing, perhaps a different lawyer.
In the bankruptcy court?
In the bankruptcy court.
Right.
That this is entirely unenforceable.
I think I would go back to this. I look at the discreteness of what the court asked in the petition and its order. And it just said, is this kind of a provision where it says settlement, is that void as against public policy? Again, my position is, as I've already expressed, is yes for a couple of reasons. But the main point is this. You can't, you know, there's this question of like, my adversary said something I thought was kind of telling because.
You didn't ask for a rebuttal. There was a specific question that was asked of you. Does this relate to that question?
I actually did. I did ask for a 2-minute of rebuttal, briefly.
I apologize.
That's up to the court anyway, so I don't want to over-talk.
No, Mr. Confucione, that was my error. I see the note.
And did I answer the question the court had in terms of, in other words, what's going to be argued in the bankruptcy?
I'm saying it to put it very simply, and I know you've argued many times before this court.
Yeah.
You often use very evocative language. I think I'm hearing a maybe.
Well, I
think I'm hearing a sort of maybe kind of, and we'll see how it all goes.
I think I would say
and
that
sometimes lawyers have to do that. I'm not.
Yeah,
critical.
No, and I don't, and I, that's I'm, what I'm trying to be. I'm trying to take the procedural posture of the case. The only issue before the court, as I view it, is what the court granted the order on.
So just to be clear,
yeah,
your argument is that the provision that Ms. Arsenis agrees not to contest the non-dischargeability is void for public policy. But you haven't argued that a provision that says that you will not contest the allegations is void for public policy.
Correct.
Okay.
Is it true, Mr. Confusione, that your client wanted the citation of the bankruptcy?
I was going to address that. Again, I wasn't the lawyer, of course, below, but when I looked at the record.
Are we here about a provision that is in the current form it's in because your client pushed for that?
No, I didn't see any finding by the trial court that said that, and I didn't see anything in the appellate division that said that.
Why would the trial court even get involved with that?
Well, the trial court did go. Basically, the procedural posture, as I understood the motion, was they basically said, here's the final settlement agreement, and we want this signed. Okay, and in that settlement agreement, there were provisions that I pointed to here that my client said, we object, we never agreed to those provisions. Now, who originally it suggested language, that was never found by the trial court. They didn't get that far. They just said, you agreed with the provisions that are in the final settlement agreement, we're gonna make you sign it. So I actually think the statement by my adversary is not part of the record before this court here. That was never a finding by any court below.
Counsel, is there anything else you'd like to add?
I would just like to say this. I think this is a very important part. It's almost like, well, why are these two provisions in there? Because part of my adversary's argument is like, well, really, they don't really mean anything because the bankruptcy court's going to determine it anyway. But she said something very telling. She said, we were hoping it would, quote, narrow the issues for hearing. Well, that in and of itself violates the bankruptcy code under that subsection C of 523, which subsumes the right of a debtor to contest. So, you know, the problem with deferring, as my adversary is trying to say, is that it will, as Justice Albin said, it will essentially muzzle people's rights, because if you put these provisions in these settlement agreements, people are not going to seek bankruptcy protection. And if it was a New Jersey right, maybe the court could, you know, say, well, we think this right prevails over that. But we're kind of handcuffed as a state because we have this federal governing bankruptcy code whose purpose is to give people a fresh start, except for these tiny enumerated exceptions. And going back to the specific question the court answered, I think the easy answer is it's not valid. The other provisions that aren't at issue, I mean, if they're not at issue here. And I would rest otherwise on what I've said already.
Thank you very much, counsel.
Thank you for hearing the case.
Advocacy on both sides. We'll take the case under advisement.